Well, thanks very much, Pedro, for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be talking to all of you at Perimeter. So today I'm going to be talking about a paper that came out about a month and a half ago on an interesting connection I found between relativistic scattering amplitudes and the Riemann zeta function. Right, so let's get to it. So first, just a few words about the motivation for this talk. Why should one be studying the Riemann zeta function in the context of scattering amplitudes? Why should we be seeking connection between these two seemingly disparate concepts? So a few just background words about Riemann zeta. Introduced by Bernard Riemann in 1859, it's one of the most famous functions in number theory. It's a particular function of a single complex variable. So you take 1 over n to the z, where z is your complex variable, and you sum on the integers. And this defines zeta for z with real part bigger than 1, but you can extend to the rest of the complex plane by analytic continuation. And it's known to have a whole host of really interesting properties, with, in particular, deep connections to the distribution of the prime numbers. There's this famous product proven first by Euler, where zeta can be written as the sum of 1 over 1 minus p to the minus z, where the product where you multiply over all the different primes. And in particular, zeta has connections to the famous prime counting function pi of x, where pi is just the number of primes less than x. And it's been the subject of 150 years of intense mathematical interest. And so just a few of the most relevant properties for this talk. It has a single pole at z equals 1, corresponding to the harmonic series 1 over 1 plus 1 over 2 plus 1 over 3, et cetera. So it's a divergent series. And it has trivial zeros at negative even integers. These are called the trivial zeros due to the functional equation that zeta enjoys relating zeta and 1 minus zeta. So due to this sine factor, you get these zeros here. But more importantly, if we zoom out a little, so here I've plotted the phase of zeta, we find that there's a collection of additional zeros that all seem to lie on a certain critical line where z has real part 1/2. Seem to, I say, because this hasn't been proven, it's just been checked empirically for lots and lots of different zeros. And so noticing an interesting feature that all lies on a line should make you start thinking that maybe there's a connection to scattering amplitudes, and we'll get to that shortly. So here, I'll write down the imaginary parts of these zeros as mu n. So the first mu's are like 14, 21, et cetera. And we'll take real mu to be positive throughout, even though the zeros are mirrored across z equals zero. Now, mu, of course, could in principle be imaginary, but as I said, all the known mu's are real. And that brings me to the Riemann hypothesis, which is the assertion that all of the non-trivial zeros do indeed lie on the critical line with real part 1/2. And if true, it would have a lot of nice number theory consequences. For example, for the distribution of the primes relating pi of x to this nice logarithmic integral, it gets quite close to this estimate if the Riemann hypothesis is true. And it's one of the most famous problems in math, one of Hilbert's great 23 problems, and it's currently been verified as of last year for the first 12 trillion zeros. But there are other open questions. Are all the zeros simple zeros? What can be proven about the statistical properties of the zeros? What is the asymptotic behavior of zeta on the critical line? And it turns out that all of these questions have images in a scattering amplitude that I'll construct in this talk. And all these questions will have some physical interpretation at the level of the scattering amplitude. Now, there's also a long history of at least attempts to connect the Riemann zeta function to something physical, dating back 100 years to attributed to a remark by Landau here to Polya. The question is, do there exist a quantum Hamiltonian whose eigenvalues correspond to the imaginary parts of the non-trivial zeros of zeta? And this is Montgomery, well, this is related to Montgomery's famous pair correlation conjecture potentially, where it's been noted that the correlation function for the normalized spacings of the non-trivial zeros satisfies the same two-point function as a Gaussian unitary ensemble. So it's thought that there's some sort of chaotic dynamics that leads to it leads to a Hamiltonian whose eigenvalues indeed correspond to these non-trivial zeros. If true, that would give you a physical proof of the Riemann hypothesis. Such a proof does not exist yet, but other notable works on quantum chaotic non-relativistic scattering in the context of the Riemann zeta function include work by Gutzwiller, Srednicki, and these authors here. So that's all background. But in this talk, we're going to do something rather different. Rather than trying to prove the Riemann hypothesis, we want to see, can we gain any insight if we somehow recast the zeta function as a relativistic scattering amplitude? So the general idea here is take some interesting function from number theory, reinterpret as a scattering amplitude, and then hopefully find interesting new physics as a result. And there's a notable previous illustrious precedent for taking this process. And that's Veneziano in 1968 took the Euler beta function, asked, you know, can I reinterpret this as a relativistic scattering amplitude? And you can, it's the Veneziano amplitude, which famously led to most of string theory. So it would be nice if something similar could happen with the Riemann zeta. As we'll see in this talk, we will get through, you know, basically the green step, maybe halfway to the blue step. We won't yet find what the fundamental physics is that generates this amplitude, but we will construct the amplitude and probe its properties. And indeed, the Veneziano amplitude itself can be written in terms of the zeta function, famously by Freund and Witten in 1987. So you can take a Bose symmetrized version of the Veneziano amplitude, and you can write it, of course, in terms of the Euler beta function. But you can write this as a product of ratios of zetas. But this relation to zeta in that context is somewhat illusory. The non-trivial zeros of the zeta function in this ratio cancel out entirely due to this nice identity. So you can write it just purely in terms of gamma functions and none of the interesting structure of the non-trivial zeros of Riemann zeta appears in the Veneziano amplitude. So we instead want to find an amplitude where that structure does appear and does play an important role. So in this talk, what we'll do is construct a relativistic four-point amplitude, M, that truly captures those non-trivial properties of the zeta function. In particular, various properties of the amplitude will map onto properties of zeta and vice versa. So in particular, the poles at S or U equals M squared, where M will be the spectrum of the theory, requiring those poles be real will be equivalent to the Riemann hypothesis. Requiring that those poles are local, so there's all simple poles in the amplitude, no higher order poles, will correspond to the fact that the zeta function is meromorphic in the complex plane. Requiring that all the massive states described by this amplitude have universal coupling to the light states will correspond to the simple zero conjecture on the zeta function. Dispersive bounds from analyticity and unitarity, these first principles bounds that one can place on the Wilson coefficients of an EFT, of a low energy scattering amplitude, will correspond to requiring that the sequence 1 over mu n squared has all positive odd moments. A couple more things. The amplitude will prove to be on-shell constructible, and we'll see that this is dual to the Hadamard product expansion of the Riemann zeta function. And CPT invariance of the amplitude will have a nice avatar in the form of the reflection of the zeros across the critical line in the zeta function. All right, so that's what we're going to show. Any questions before we get into that, please interrupt me at any time.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Can you say again how exactly the z in the Riemann zeta function is related to the s and t variables?
I haven't told you that because I haven't constructed this amplitude yet. So that's what I'm going to do now. I'm going to write down M explicitly in terms of zeta and various other functions. So what I want to do is find a function M that enjoys this nice duality. As we'll see, what I'll construct is arguably the simplest such function that does the job.
I see.
Great question.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so now let's do that. Let's try and find a function that will manifest these properties that we want. All right, so we're going to try and build a scattering amplitude. So the most important feature of zeta, and actually why I thought to do this, is that the non-trivial zeros all appear to lie on a line. And this reminded me of scattering amplitudes because in a well-behaved scattering amplitude, the poles all lie on lines corresponding to S, T, or U equals M squared. So scattering amplitudes have features that are linear in a complex variable, and so does zeta. So let's try using that to our advantage. So we'll consider a four-point amplitude. I'll define the Mandelstam variables S, T, and U in the usual way, and I'll take the external states to all be massless for simplicity. All right, so let's first start by just trying to build the forward amplitude. So we only have a single complex variable to deal with for now. So we'll set T to zero. And suppose that the amplitude we're building is described by S and U channel exchange. And we want the poles to correspond to the zeros of the zeta function. So what we're going to build is this function A of S ultimately. So what could A of S be? Well, the first thing that you might try is what if A of S is just 1/(zeta)/(1/2)+is. So here you will have poles corresponding to the zeros of the zeta function at S equals mu n. But what you immediately find a problem. There are poles with opposite sign residues. So here you can see it's going up and then coming from the negative, and then here it's diving down negative and coming from positive m. And that means one of these two has to be a tachyon. You have opposite sign residues, and that's not allowed in a physical amplitude. So we have to try harder. Well, what if we hit it with a derivative? So zeta prime of 1/(1/2)+is over zeta of 1/(1/2)+is. That doesn't work either. That gives you a forward amplitude that doesn't have any poles. So that's not very interesting. Well, what else can we do? Well, what if we square root things for reasons that will become clear? So 1/(1/2)+i/s everywhere. Well, we get poles, but we get only poles in the wrong places at s equals 4n+1/2/4. And we'll see what those are in a second. All right. Well, if we divide by the square root of s, then at least the real part of the forward amplitude starts having what we want. We get one of the poles corresponding to the non-trivial zeros at s equals mu 1 squared, and numerical analysis shows that indeed you get poles at s equals mu n squared, but you have all these other annoying poles in the wrong places that we have to somehow get rid of. But we're getting close. This will be a useful starting point. And so if we just try and by hand cancel all the wrong poles by computing their residues and adding terms to remove them, and then summing up that infinite sum where we have all this infinite sum of poles here, we get a digamma function showing up. We'll add another term to make the forward amplitude real, and add one other term to cancel the one final weird extra pole at s equals -1/4. And we get a form of A of S that does exactly what we want. It has poles at S equals mu n squared. And so all those poles are real, provided that the Riemann hypothesis is true, in which case all the mu n are real. So here, you know, this pole is around 14 squared, this pole is around 21 squared, etc. All right, so here's our function. This is our amplitude. It's A of S plus A of U is going to be the amplitude we'll consider. But it turns out I can write this in a much nicer form. So first a few comments. This is the digamma function. It's just gamma prime over gamma. And the digamma function has poles at negative integers. And they cancel the zeros in the zeta function at the negative even integers for n bigger than zero. So these are precisely chosen to conspire to get rid of the trivial zeros. Furthermore, the pole in the Di gamma function at zero is canceled by this term here. And despite all of the square roots everywhere, you might worry that this is non-analytic, right? That there are branch cuts all over the place. But it turns out there aren't. All the branch cuts have conspired to cancel. So if I send epsilon to zero and compute the discontinuity across the real s-axis, indeed there is no discontinuity. I can write this much nicer in terms of the Landau-Riemann Xi functions. So let me define the capital Xi function as the little Xi function evaluated at 1/2 plus iz, where the little Xi function is given here in terms of, yes.
There's no square roots or the...
There's no square roots in terms of these Xi functions, but the square roots will come back.
Sorry, but the function has a discontinuity at positive s, right? It is just, it vanishes at s equals zero, right? But this function has a discontinuity.
No, there is no discontinuity. So here, this is the limit of epsilon goes to zero of s plus I epsilon minus s minus I. Yeah. At positive or negative s, there is no discontinuity in this function. In fact, I'll prove to you that this function is meromorphic with poles only at s equals mu n squared. Yeah. Okay. Great. It's very strange looking though, I agree. So, okay, in terms of these Landau-Riemann Xi functions, I can write A as just minus dds of log of capital Xi of root s. And I'm defining M of s as M of s and t as A of s plus A of u. Okay, so now let's try and understand some of the properties of A of s a little more in depth. So first of all, you can argue that M is the simplest possible amplitude corresponding to the Riemann zeta function that satisfies three physical properties. Property one, we wanted M to be analytic everywhere except for poles corresponding to the non-trivial zeros of the Riemann zeta function, but not any of the trivial zeros, and such that those poles are real if the Riemann hypothesis holds. Two, we want each of the poles to have positive residue as required by unitarity. And three, for reasons that will become clear, I want the forward amplitude to satisfy having non-zero second derivative at small s. That will be as a result of dispersion relations. So let's take a look at this third property a little bit more and ask, were the square roots really necessary? Did we really need that complication of the square roots? And it turns out we did. If I send s to s squared in the forward amplitude to get rid of all the square roots, then I find that the forward amplitude actually scales with s to the fourth at small momentum rather than s squared. And you can show that you need that s squared scaling of the forward amplitude because of analytic dispersion relations. So that square root was totally necessary. Let's look at a few other properties of A of S. There's a nice connection between the low momentum behavior and the zeros of zeta that we can already see, but we'll dig into this in a lot more detail shortly. So let me just define C naught over 2 as the limit of A of S as S goes to zero. And you can write it in terms of some fundamental constants. Here G is Catalan's constant, gamma is the Euler-Mascheroni constant, and the second derivative of zeta evaluated at 1/2. If I make use of the Hadamard product form of the zeta function, more on this later, I can rewrite that second derivative of zeta at 1/2 to write C naught as just the sum from 1 to infinity of 2 over mu n squared, which is a positive number, and it's guaranteed to be positive if the Riemann hypothesis holds, because in that case, all the mu's are real. Right. So this is the sort of first moment of that sequence of 1 over mu n squared. It's just the sum of the sequence. And we'll be, in general, looking at all the odd moments of that sequence. As I mentioned, this function A of s has poles corresponding to the non-trivial zeros of zeta, zeta at 1/2 plus or minus I mu n. And so if the Riemann hypothesis holds, these poles are all at real positive masses. So the spectrum of this theory is just mn equals mu n. And as a check, we find that they all have the correct positive residue required by unitarity. So if I send s to s plus I epsilon in the Feynman I epsilon prescription and compute the residue around s equals mu n squared, it's a positive number. In fact, to be specific, if the nth zero of Riemann zeta has order gn, so that zeta goes like z minus zn to the gn, then this residue is just 2 pi gn. So this means if the simple zero hypothesis holds, so all the mu n's are simple zeros, there's universal coupling. The residue here is just uniform for all of the massive poles. But we won't assume the simple zero conjecture for the rest of this talk, and we don't need to assume it, and we can write all the gn's as just one if we allow the mu n's to be degenerate, as we'll see. Right. Okay. So now what I want to do is look a little more closely at the simplicity of the poles of A of S. So not the simplicity of the zeros of zeta, but simplicity of the poles here. And so this is related to locality. So higher degree poles will correspond to kinetic terms with too many derivatives. That's a failure of locality. So if instead of kinetic terms that look like box minus m squared phi, if it looked like box minus m squared all to the k times phi, I would get propagators that look like 1 over minus s plus m squared to the k. So this is a failure of locality at the level of the amplitude. And if this were to happen, this would correspond to an essential singularity of Riemann zeta. If I just track this behavior through the definition of A of S given here and ask what does this do to the zeta function, what it does is it would give me behavior near the nth zero going like e to the alpha over z minus zn all to the k minus one, which is an essential singularity. And so the fact that the zeta function is meromorphic is dual to locality of this function A that we've constructed, this amplitude. Right. So here's a picture of what the amplitude looks like. This is the norm of the amplitude, and the color denotes the phase. And so we see a bunch of nice poles, at least for the first four poles, and it seems to fall off nicely at infinity. And I'll prove that later in this talk, a way to rewrite A in terms of the poles explicitly. Right, so now we're going to change gears a little bit and ask what does this amplitude look like when viewed as an EFT. So what are the connections to analytic dispersion relations, and what can it tell us about the Wilson coefficients of the EFT associated with this amplitude? So any questions before we get into that? Okay, hearing none, we will forge ahead. So just a few words about analytic dispersion relations. Can any Lagrangian be a consistent effective field theory? Any Lagrangian you write down? It turns out the answer is no. Certain signs or magnitudes of couplings violate fundamental physics principles, things like unitarity of quantum mechanics, causality of signal propagation, locality, self-consistency of thermodynamics, etc. So from the menu of particles, interactions, couplings, and symmetries, there are certain combinations that are allowed and certain combinations that are forbidden. And so this all goes under the moniker of infrared consistency requirements. And in the infrared consistency program, which is closely related to the Swampland program in string theory, there's been a lot of work over the past years by myself, my collaborators, and many other people on bounding a whole host of different theories of either phenomenological interest or more formal theoretical interest, like corrections to GR, corrections to Maxwell theory, etc. Now, our amplitude built from the zeta function will by definition satisfy the requirements of analyticity and unitarity for scattering amplitudes for reasons that we'll see. But we can turn this question around and ask what happens if we just simply run our function through the mechanics of the analytic dispersion relations, and what does this tell us about the relation between the Wilson coefficients in this amplitude and properties of zeta? So let's do that now and see what we get. So first, let me briefly review how infrared consistency can be used to place constraints on the coefficients of an EFT based on analyticity, which is sort of the Fourier transform of locality, unitarity, and causality. And so this is based on the foundational work of Adams et al. From 2006. So as an example of this, consider a massless scalar with a shift symmetry. So phi is our massless scalar. And since it enjoys a shift symmetry, the first higher derivative operator you can write down is d phi of the 4 with some Wilson coefficient that if you know the UV, you can compute explicitly. But if you don't know the UV, it's just some number. And here m is some scale parameterizing the UV. So the 2-to-2 scattering amplitude for this theory looks like s squared plus t squared plus u squared times c. And our forward amplitude, so forward means in-state equals out-state, so t is 0. And so we have just c times s squared. So let's do a little complex analysis to extract the Wilson coefficient. So we'll do some contour around the origin to extract c. And we'll use the fact that the forward amplitude is analytic almost everywhere in the complex plane to deform the contour. So here, this is the complex S-plane, and a fact about amplitudes is they're analytic everywhere except the real S-axis, where you can have branch cuts or you can have poles. Our amplitude just has poles, but in general, you can have branch cuts. Right, so we deform to some new contour, C prime, running above and below the real S-axis plus some boundary term at infinity. And the boundary term vanishes under relatively weak assumptions. That is, if the amplitude at large s scales more weakly than s squared, then this boundary term vanishes. And why should it scale more weakly than s squared at large momentum? Well, if the UV completion is doing its job, it's preventing an apparent failure of perturbative unitarity. Right. This is one of the reasons for the existence of the Higgs boson, for example. If you compute WW scattering in the standard model EFT, that scattering diverges as momentum squared, unless you add the Higgs, which makes it diverge as momentum to the zero. So UV completions in general should soften that scaling from, in this case, S squared to something weaker than S squared. You can also prove this using causality that amplitudes have to scale more weakly than S squared at large S in general. Right, okay. Next I'll use crossing symmetry. In this case, so crossing symmetry allows me to swap.
How does that proof go? The causality one?
So I didn't go that through that in general. I was just mentioning there's a proof in, let me see, in the EFT Hedron paper of Arkani Hamed and Wang, where they show in the appendices that if you have a failure of sub S squared scattering in a gravitational theory, and actually in a non-gravitational theory, you can do better. This is the Fourier transform of essentially being able to send signals outside your light cone. Basically, the large momentum behavior of the 4-point amplitude, if you take two of the legs to be like an on-shell VEV, you can relate that to the time advance or time delay associated with sending a signal through a background. And at large momentum, this corresponds to sort of like the wavefront velocity. So
I don't see why. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we can come back to that later if there's time. But right. So now I'm going to use crossing symmetry to relate m of s comma t to m of u comma t. So all I'm doing is I'm swapping particles 1 and 3. And for the forward amplitude, that means that m of s comma 0 equals m of minus s comma 0. So now let me rewrite what I mean by this continuity. And I'll use the Schwarz reflection principle, which tells me that if I have some analytic function in the complex plane that's real in some domain of the real axis, then if I conjugate its argument, that's the same thing as conjugating the function. And so I can rewrite C as the integral of the imaginary part of M evaluated over the positive real S-axis. And now I'm just using the optical theorem, which is a consequence of unitarity, to write C as this integral over the cross section. And cross sections are positive, they are areas, so C is positive. So this is just the background. So now let me apply these ideas to our particular M of S. And more generally, I could have done additional subtractions divided by higher powers of S to extract the higher power in S coefficient of the forward amplitude at low energies. And what you can show is that even derivatives of the forward amplitude at small s are all positive. Okay, so now what I want to do is apply this dispersion relation formalism to our scattering amplitude. So I'll define a power series of the forward amplitude at small momentum. So I'll rewrite M of S comma zero as the sum over K from zero to infinity of C 2K S to the 2K. And I'll do the same thing. I'll extract the Wilson coefficient.
So here you have in mind the scattering of open strings, I guess, right?
Not necessarily.
Exactly, but you don't have full crossing symmetry. You only have SU crossing.
Yeah, I only have SU crossing. And you could think of that in quantum field theory as though I have two distinct massless states that I'm scattering. So let me call them like phi one and phi two. And so this is like the amplitude for phi one phi two goes to phi one phi two, which means I have SU crossing but not full STU.
And you have poles in S and in T, but you don't have poles in U.
No, I have poles in S and U, but not in T. So I want there to be,
So you don't have poles one and the minus one variables? Okay. It would be what you would also get in a large N open string theory, right? One of the channels is suppressed. But fine, I agree. It can be more generic. And your particles are massless, the external one.
Yeah, they're massless.
And so in principle, there would be cuts going all the way to S equals zero, and these derivatives would not be defined at zero, right?
If I was looking at a loop amplitude, yes. So if I included loops, but here I'm assuming that that I'm working in a weakly coupled theory so that I can first, so that there's a sensible loop expansion and I can just ask about the tree level amplitude. So here, at least my A of S has no cuts, it just has poles. So that means it's describing some leading tree amplitude.
Then the imaginary part is zero.
No, it's not zero because I can, well, one over S minus M squared plus I epsilon has non-zero imaginary part.
Okay, so you have a three level amplitude in mind. Basically.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right, so, We're just going to essentially relate these Wilson coefficients to the spectrum in this theory. So let me extract the Wilson coefficient with a contour integral. So again, it's some integral over the cross section divided by S to the necessary power to extract the power that I'm interested in, plus a boundary term. And in general, because this isn't a priori a well-behaved amplitude. It's something I just constructed from the zeta function. I have to check whether these boundary terms vanish. I can't actually use the physical arguments to guarantee that the boundary terms vanish. So these boundary terms are residues at infinity of the forward amplitude. But you can show that if any of these boundary terms were non-zero, that would mean this Riemann-Landau psi function grows at least as fast as e to the z to the 4k plus 2 for whatever k is non-zero. So this is called growth order in complex analysis. And so this is growth order 4k plus 2. And the growth order of the Riemann-Landau psi function has been computed since the 50s, and it's known to be growth order 1. So all the C2Ks, all the C infinities actually vanish. Right, so that means we can relate these Wilson coefficients to nice integrals over cross sections. And just explicitly computing them, we have a beautiful relation between the Wilson coefficients and the odd moments of these sums over the non-trivial zeros. So C0 we already computed, but C2, the coefficient of S squared, goes like 1 over mu n to the sixth. The coefficient of S to the fourth goes like 1 over mu n to the 10th, etc. And so the Riemann hypothesis guarantees that these are all positive. And let's focus in on the S squared coefficient that corresponds to like the d phi of the 4 operator that we were talking about previously. This gives us a remarkable identity relating the zeta function and its various derivatives, all evaluated at 1/2. Here I'm using shorthand where subscripts denote nth derivatives and superscripts denote those derivatives to some power. And so we get this complicated combination of zeta derivatives evaluated at 1/2 equals just this simple sum of 2/(μn⁶), where mu n are all the non-trivial zeros of zeta. So we got this physically. We got this identity using physics, using these analytic dispersion relations. But in principle, this is something that one should be able to prove just by math, not using physics. And you can, with great effort, by computing analytic expressions for the derivatives of z at 1/2 and using polygamma identities and the product form of the zeta function, which comes from Hadamard's expansion. But what's remarkable is that our amplitude construction here allows for much simpler physical derivations of such identities as this. And you can, with care, numerically compute the first few of these CKs in the expansion of the forward amplitude. And indeed, they're all positive, as you'd expect. And in fact, numerical tests of C4, 6, 8, 10 confirm the prediction of the analytic dispersion relations, confirm this beautiful identity to within a relative error of 10^-30, where there the error is dominated by the numerical error in our knowledge of the location of the zeros of the zeta function. Right. This brings me to other properties that I promised to show you from that table. So as I was just discussing with Pedro, our amplitude describes a theory of two types of massless scalars, phi 1 and phi 2, exchanging a tower of massive states that I'll call X in the S and U channels. So it looks like these diagrams in describing the amplitude for phi 1, phi 2 goes to phi 1, phi 2. Now that's, in a sense, the most minimal option because I just used A of S plus A of U, but I could alternatively have defined M with full Bose symmetry, writing it as A of S plus A of T plus A of U, in which case our amplitude would describe just single scalar scattering for phi phi goes to phi phi. That's another option. These identities would have been different, but similar. And so that's another amplitude that that might be worth considering, the fully Bose symmetrized version of this. Importantly, the spectrum of X is just given by mn squared equals mu n squared, as I've mentioned. And based on the properties of A, our Riemann zeta amplitude is actually on-shell constructible from the UV amplitude. So in the UV theory, we have these kind of half amplitudes, phi 1, phi 2 goes to X. And here in principle, these half amplitudes would be dependent on the momenta of particles 1 and 2, right? So here, these P arguments are the momenta for phi 1 and phi 2. And so you can show that our M of ST is just given by this half amplitude times the propagator times this half amplitude, plus the same thing for the U channel. A half amplitude times the U channel propagator times another half amplitude. And in fact, because we've found that all of the residues enjoy uniform coupling, these half amplitudes, these UV amplitudes are all constant. They're just one in our units, although I could have multiplied by some overall dimensional coupling. So that's cool. All the UV theory describes is just constant amplitudes for two massless objects merging to form a massive object. And the amplitude of four-point scattering in the theory just is described by this nice on-shell constructible form. And so this implies a beautiful result that A of S, so minus the derivative of log of psi of root S, is just given by the sum over n of 1/(-S+μn²). This is not at all obvious at the level of the definition of the psi function that I wrote down earlier. But we can prove it, and so let's do that. Incidentally, M of s here, if I put back in the I epsilons, is given similarly. It's 1 over minus s plus mu n squared minus I epsilon plus the same thing in the U channel. All right, so let's prove this. We'll let delta be A of s, our form of A of s here, minus what we want to show that it is, minus this nice sum over the non-trivial zeros of the zeta function. So we've previously shown that A has zeros only at s equals mu n squared. And if we allow some of the mu n to be degenerate, so we're not assuming the simple zero conjecture, all the residues are one. So this means that this delta function is entire. It's everywhere holomorphic in the complex S-plane. Fine. Let's expand delta in a Laurent series around S equals infinity. And the definition of delta S and the absence of a pole at infinity in A of S, which we've shown previously, imply that delta is a bounded function. So Liouville's theorem tells us that delta is constant. Wonderful. So by our evaluation of C naught, delta of zero equals zero. And so this delta function vanishes everywhere and we have the result we wanted. Now this nice result implies something very nice, implies Hadamard's famous product form for the zeta function. So we can integrate it and it gives us the product form for the Riemann-Landau psi function, which I can write here in terms of the little psi function. And so I get this nice product form of zeta, which if I insert the Weierstrass product for the gamma function, here's Weierstrass, along with our knowledge of what zeta is at zero, if I give myself one point where I can evaluate zeta, I get the nice Hadamard product. So we got this from this form of A of S, and this form of A of S came from the fact that the amplitude is on-shell constructible from its UV amplitudes. Finally, I'll just say a few words about reflection symmetry of the zeros and their relation to the CPT theorem. So Riemann's functional equation for the zeta function, along with Schwarz reflection, tells you that the zeta zeros in general have a fourfold symmetry. So if there's a zero at 1/2 plus I mu, where here I'm not assuming mu is real, mu could be complex if the Riemann hypothesis fails. There's this fourfold symmetry, 1/2 plus I mu, 1/2 plus I mu star, 1/2 minus I mu, and 1/2 minus I mu star. If the Riemann hypothesis is true, it's just a twofold symmetry because mu is real. Now, we previously showed, though, that the imaginary part of forward amplitude is non-zero only because of the Feynman I epsilon deformation. As Pedro correctly pointed out, there would be no imaginary part of the forward amplitude had we not put in this I epsilon, if I just evaluate at s minus mu n squared. So that's nice. That's very physical. It tells you that, well, this is what you expect from the tree level exchange of a tower of massive states. And so what this tells us is that the symmetry of the zeros enjoyed by Riemann zeta tells us that we have momentum conservation in the optical theorem, that the cross section here is non-zero only for on shell X. That is to say, if I had a violation of the Riemann hypothesis where mu is some M minus IW for some non-zero W, this would give me an extra imaginary part of the forward amplitude going like W for some W much less than M. But the symmetry of the zeros tells me that such Ws come in pairs with plus or minus W. And these correspond to the existence of both growing and decaying modes, which is guaranteed to you by the CPT theorem. So again, here we find symmetry of zeros is related to a nice consequence of CPT. One other comment I would add is that the zero counting function, n of t, which tells you the number of zeros with height less than t, is just given simply by the integral of the cross section of this amplitude from zero to root t. So that's another nice physical interpretation of a feature of Riemann zeta. Right, so that's those are the results that I found in this paper, but I'll say a few words about future directions. So the important takeaway is that we've constructed an amplitude whose physical attributes correspond to known or conjectured properties of the non-trivial zeros of zeta, which I've hopefully convinced you of in this talk. But there's a lot of future directions one could go with this. A big open question is, of course, what dynamics gives rise to this amplitude, which is equivalent to the Hilbert-Pauliot problem. What is the theory described by M of SNT? That's a very high bar. It's the analog of, given the Veneziano amplitude, please describe all of string theory. But you know, it seems definitely worthy of investigation whether some relativistic theory can be constructed giving rise to this amplitude. And this isn't something that's really been investigated before. People have thought a lot about non-relativistic scattering. People have talked a lot about the Schrodinger equation and writing down Hamiltonians corresponding to Riemann zeta. But trying to tackle it from kind of a modern relativistic amplitudes perspective hasn't been done, and I think is worth doing. Other future directions include adding spin for the intermediate states. So I previously argued that this amplitude M is the simplest function that satisfies several physical requirements that I spelled out. But I could multiply M by an everywhere holomorphic function of S, or rather I could multiply A by an everywhere holomorphic function of S. So if I instead replace A of S with F of S times A of S, where F is holomorphic, that would describe massive states with spin, because now suddenly my residues all depend on momentum, and so that means I have propagators that are momentum dependent, hence spinning states. So that would be cool to investigate. Another interesting direction would be to ask,
is the statement you just said correct? Can you repeat the statement? It sounds incorrect.
The statement.
What
was
the statement that you just said now? That you multiply what by what?
So I have this function A of S, and I took my amplitude to be A of S plus A of U. But mm-hmm. what if I take an everywhere holomorphic function F of S and define an amplitude F of S times A of S plus F of U times A of U?
This will not put spin.
Why is that?
Because at the residues, you will just shift the residue from being a constant to being the value of the new function at that position. It goes from being one to being f of mu.
That's true, it shifts the residues, but there's more to the amplitude than its residues, right?
Spin means that the residue as a function of S is a Legendre polynomial that depends on T.
Right. I should have multiplied A of S by kinematics that depend on scattering angle. Yeah, you're right.
Then it's a much more complicated problem.
That's much harder. That's much harder. Yeah, no, you're right. Thank you. Another option would be to look at zeta function universality. So the Riemann zeta function has this known universality property where in the critical strip near, so the unit strip near z equals 1/2, it's known that there's a region in that strip that reproduces the behavior of essentially any holomorphic function. So if you give me any function in the complex plane in the compact domain, I can map it to some location in that strip. What that means at the level of the amplitude, I don't yet know. Does it mean that the amplitude kind of in some sense reproduces, you know, an arbitrary spectrum or some sub spectrum of the amplitude can be used to mock up an arbitrary spectrum. That's worth looking at. Another possible generalization would be to consider Dirichlet-L functions. So everywhere I wrote zeta, replace zeta with a Dirichlet-L function. So Dirichlet-L functions are generalizations of the zeta function, where instead of 1 over n to the z, you replace the numerator with with a Dirichlet character, so a different function other than one. And so there are other things you can do with interesting functions in number theory and turn them into scattering amplitudes. And whether we can find interesting dynamics and interesting physics that corresponds to that is a question worthy of investigation. So with that, I'll take any other questions you have. And thanks again very much.
Oh, thanks a lot, Grant. Let's thank Grant. Well, let me just ask if you agree with the following statement that, I mean, you made an analogy with the Veneziano, but I thought that what was really amazing about Veneziano is the fact that it's really a genuine function of STNU, not f of s plus f of t plus f of u. And you write it as a function where you write as a function of s and t, and then you go and you check that the poles in u are positive, and remarkably they are. So it's a function that is, it's highly non-trivial that you have unitarity. It's not about using gamma function, right? You can use gamma function and write a bunch of polygamma of S plus polygamma of T plus polygamma of U, and it would also be okay. The signs would be correct, but it would not lead to string theory, right? So
yeah, I see what you're saying that at the level of Veneziano, there's kind of a miracle that occurs where you a priori, well, positivity of the residues isn't manifest at the level of the function a priori, and you check and find that it is for all the channels. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that I
yeah yeah.
Captured, so you have causing an unitarity in a non-trivial way. It's not.
That's right. Whereas here I kind of constructed that with knowledge that if I have a of s and this function has all positive residues, then certainly a of s plus a of u has all positive residues in the appropriate channels. That's right. That the fact that there's not a miracle there is kind of unavoidable when you are starting with a function of a single complex variable rather than the Veneziano starting point, which is a two variable function.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Nice talk, Grant.
Thanks.
Do you what kind of a role do you have in mind for Dirichlet characters? What in physics?
Well, off the top of my head, something I didn't ask for that this function kind of gave me for free was the uniform coupling, right? When I was building this function, I didn't try to put in by hand the fact that all the residues were one. That just kind of came out when I was trying to construct the simplest possible function that that satisfied all these nice physical properties. So that was a cool thing that came out, but I could see wanting to generalize that, right? You might want some function that describes the spectrum with a bunch of residues that aren't all the same. And I think Dirichlet characters would allow you to do that. Of course, it also changes the zeros as well. So
that's
another thing that Dirichlet characters do for you, that you can get kind of whatever spectrum you like.
But then, would the conductor of the character correspond to something physically?
I'm not sure. I haven't actually tried to build this with Dirichlet characters yet.
But it's an interesting idea, though. So.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Any other questions? You ended up slightly ahead of time, so we can ask a long question if you want.
All right,
questions about the introduction and so on, if someone wants.
Another interesting future direction that I didn't mention at the end, but is related to something you said earlier, Pedro, is about loop amplitudes, right? Because so here, we have I've given you an on-shell four-point amplitude in some theory of massless particles, and I can use standard amplitude techniques to build higher point amplitudes involving loops given the on-shell four-point amplitude, right? So I could build, for example, a 4-point amplitude containing a loop of phi 1 and phi 2 from this amplitude, and ask about what are the properties of that object. And you know, I'm not sure whether that's something that has a mathematical analog, but certainly if that object had some, you know, miraculously nice properties, that would be highly suggestive that there's something really interesting going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe one more question. What
is the electrobit effect? It's f of s plus f of t plus f of u. I would prefer an untrivial mixing between st and u, but okay.
Yeah.
It's just a taste. John, you had another question?
Oh, yeah. So what if you generalize the Riemann zeta by leaving a couple primes out of the Euler product? Does that, can you do something
to interpret that?
A partial zeta function. Let's say it's a finite number of primes.
Yeah, right. So insert that into some like modified version of the Xi function. And let's say I define the amplitude in the same way. I don't know. How delicate is the Riemann zeta function to prime
it's
deletion?
It's pretty resilient, actually.
It is, okay.
In a sense.
Interesting.
I mean, depends on what you mean, but.
Like for example, if I delete the primes, do you happen to know if the functional equation still holds? For example, like are there still the trivial zeros at the negative even integers?
You have to maybe work a little bit more to handle it, but
yeah, okay.
Usually people do it with things like Heckel functions or
okay,
but.
Yeah, so suppose I delete some of the primes, but I patch it up so that something akin to the functional equation still holds, right? So that some version of the Xi function still works. I want that because the Xi function has lots of nice properties, right? It has zeros only at the non-trivial zeros of zeta, and it's everywhere analytic. So if those holes can be patched, then that would be really another cool generalization here, you know, in parallel with like the L function direction, in that, you know, you could ask about, you know, how does this change the spectrum? How does this change the couplings? I mean, those are really the only two, in a sense, parameters of this amplitude. It's just built out of the spectrum and couplings. There's nothing kind of else going on with the amplitude. The other question would be, does this screw up the high energy behavior? Because this amplitude, as I proved, has, you know, just falls off at infinity. And you know, is that something that's also delicate or not? Hopefully that could be made robust. And in that case, yeah, you could use that to, you know, custom build whatever spectra you like. Of course, the mapping between deletion of primes and how that changes the spectrum would be, you know, at least as non-trivial as the mapping between the zeros of the zeta function and the primes, which is already highly non-trivial.
Any other questions? If not, let's thank Grant once again. Thanks, Grant.
Thank you.